only on Access Sacramento. And we continue with Mark Danner. Once again, this may contain explicit descriptions of actual torture and is not suitable for children or sensitive adults.
An opportunity where it could persuade the American people that this war of choice had to be fought. But I think it's important to realize that I'm not just talking about Iraq, I'm talking about other things, that there are a great many people in power who I think believe that over the last 30 or so years, the power of the presidency had been weakened, had been diminished, and that one of the things the attack, one of the opportunities the attack provided was, in their perception, to right that balance, to restore power to the executive, to right some of the wrongs, in their view, that took place during the Vietnam era and the Watergate era. When you look at the War Powers Resolution, the FISA law, which is the law that says you can't wiretap Americans without a warrant, that law is now being ignored. And I think one of the reasons it's being ignored is that many people in power right now believed that this was wrong, that this law was illegitimate, was mistaken. Because remember, you know, a number of the people, the most powerful people who are running the government, and I'm thinking of the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, were high officials at a very young age, relatively young age, during the Nixon and Ford administrations. And they saw this era at close hand
of America becoming just a weak.
Yeah, of a losing war, and of a president forced from office. And, you know, Mr. Cheney's on record is saying that this made the president, you know, skewed the system. It gave too much power to Congress. It made the presidency relatively powerless, and that now the balance is being righted. So there's a much broader theme going on here about who governs us, about what the powers of Congress are and what the powers of the people are. And these people have very different ideas about that and strong feelings about what happened over our lifetimes, essentially. Because, you know, my political consciousness is really bordered by Watergate. I remember vividly those hearings, you know, coming of age, really, politically during those hearings. And this is, so I guess I'm trying to say that.
That's when I became a citizen.
It is.
Somebody said to me, why did you, and I said, I'm so impressed by the United States that this would all happen and be out in the open. And, you know, I found that 1975
yes.
was an impressive. And when I was, just to give you an anecdote, yeah. when I was sworn in Lower Manhattan, they gave us a letter of welcome from the President of the United States. And what dignity the court had was lost when officials ran up and down the aisle saying, we've got to have all those Nixon letters back. Anyone need a Ford letter?
I hope you held on to the Nixon letter.
I held on to them both, but it was a...
very wise.
It was a very, very, nevertheless, very, very impressive thing to be sworn in as a citizen in Lower Manhattan with every nationality represented in this. And the judge was great, saying you're being invited into an experiment. And it needs your participation and your loyal, you know, good citizenship. Mm-hmm. It was a good moment for me, 75, for becoming a citizen.
Well, it when you look back on that, that was a moment of populism, essentially, and of the notion, you know, there is a sense in which our historical moments, our founding historical moments, mm-hmm. repeat themselves, just as our religious moments do. And it seems to me that the early 70s, 74, 75, was a moment in which, to some extent, the revolution, you know, we understand this in a revolutionary context, that the leader became an autocrat, the people rose up through its institutions and removed that leadership.
And without a shot being fired.
Exactly, without a shot being fired.
That's very, to me, impressive. Well, some of the arguments I hear, going back to the earlier point, that America, just historically, is the richest, most powerful country in the world, and that's our, you know, that's who we are. And we have an empire, and we should act accordingly. Now, the acting accordingly can, depending on how you work with imperial power, but to pretend that we're not an imperial power, I sensed frustrated a lot of people more on the right, and said, look, you're being naive. We have this enormous influence, and power. Let's use it. They would say for good in mm-hmm. the world, and And don't be kind of coy about being an imperial power.
Well, I think that's a very astute perception. I think that, you know, if you look at the language being used, one of the phrases I go back to is after 9/11, this is something Kofor Black, the head of counterterrorism, said right months after 9/11. After 9/11, he said, the gloves came off.
Right.
And that phrase, I think, bears scrutiny. You know, we've heard it a lot. The president said it. But I think you have to point to the clear implication there. It's almost too obvious to point to. But the implication is that before 9/11, the gloves were on. That in some way the powers inherent in the United States were not being used and to their fullest. And to that extent, the attack, to some extent, could have been prevented if those powers had been used. So there's a whole system that fits back into this notion of what happened in the early 70s, the idea of gloving American power, etc. I mean, I have to go back, though, to a point you made about imperial power. I think that one of the misperceptions we're living under now, and that perhaps we're coming to perceive gradually, is this misperception about American power. I think this administration in particular, but others as well, believe that the United States is the overwhelming preponderant power of the world. And perhaps that is true. But the question is, what does that mean? And I think American power bears a little bit of scrutiny. I mean, the United States has the power unprecedented in history to destroy things. We have an enormous amount of power to blow things up, to destroy capitals, to do other things, to occupy countries. But to build a lasting order in their place takes a great deal more power. And we're seeing that played out in Iraq right now. That, you know, Napoleon had this line I love to quote, which is that you can do everything with a bayonet except sit on it. Mm-hmm. Don't think about that too much. but obviously, you know, he means military power is limited. You can get there with it. But the idea of actually building a new order, constructing a new politics,
and having a really secure thing. It was on the Bill Maher show last night. There's a little vignette that he does, which was that there's evidently a big soccer tournament going on, and soccer's big in the rest of the world, if not here.
Right.
There are 31 or 35 countries taking part, and they're going around. They have buses. America is part of that. All, you know, if we say it's 35, 34 buses have emblazoned on them their flag. And we're not putting our flag on our bus because of the fear of being blown up. So that doesn't feel very secure in terms of...
No, it doesn't.
How we're viewed in the world. Does anyone... I mean, how about that? How about the rest of the world and its perceptions of us?
Well, I think that, you know, as usual, we tend to measure what we can measure. Mm-hmm. So we measure the number of bombs we have and the amount of territory we can seize. It's very difficult to compare that. You know, we have 10,000 nuclear weapons, for example. How do you compare that kind of power to the loss of power represented by the destruction of American legitimacy, which is really what you're referring to? Because that kind of power, the power of America as an idea, the power of democracy as an idea, and so on, has certainly been very badly damaged, above all by the Iraq War. There's no question about that. I mean, you can measure these things to some extent by taking polls in other countries and so on, and insofar as you want a poll, for example, in the Muslim world, you'll find that the United States has suffered a catastrophic collapse in credibility, legitimacy, and people admiring the system. The question is, you know, that you just give an example, and one could cite many, many more of the attitude of people in the world toward the United States. How do you weigh that against 10,000 nuclear weapons? I'm not so sure, but it's certainly a great loss in power. There's no question about it. And I'm not sure how you get it back is the other difficult thing to quantify. I mean, how do you restore it?
I know. The the fact, what seems to be emerging, at least, is some consensus across the board now that Iraq is a mess. this week's Economist.
That left-wing crazy
that left-wing
journal.
Crazy thing says what. This is the Economist. This is the Economist at April 29. What happens? Whatever happens, there will now be no orderly transition to democratic government in Iraq. Whatever happens. Nor at this stage can Iraq's own politics resolve things at a stroke. Even if Mr. Maliki does manage to draw some Sunni Arabs into his administration, other Sunni groups aided by Al-Qaeda types will fight on, along with some Shias who want total victory over the rivals. The grim prospect is for several more years of violence in which a reduced American force does what it can to hold the country together, support the new government, and tilt the battle against the insurgents. It will be slow and grueling. But the prospect of quitting altogether, leaving behind an emboldened Al-Qaeda and a new failed state in the heart of the Middle East, would be much worse. So your choice there in The Economist is between something really, really awful and something really, really, really awful.
And that's the sunny view of things.
Not the sunny. The sunny.
Well, I think that's true. And I also think that, you know, there is the perception in the United States that there's an argument between people who think things are going well in Iraq and people who think things are going badly. And it's a very strange political situation here with that perception, because there isn't really a legitimate point of view of people who think things are going well. There isn't. I mean, if you...
You might find isolated things where a school is built or...
Of course. But I mean, if you're considering what's happening on the ground in Iraq, any of the numbers you want to look at, from number of deaths per month to number of attacks to territory seized to the growing number of insurgents themselves, to the growing parts of areas of the country that are in a critical situation as defined by the Government Accounting Office. I mean, anything you want to look at says that things are getting worse in Iraq, not better. And that's been true for quite a while. You know, our government is saying constantly that actually things are looking up, but there's essentially just nothing to justify it. You know, it's funny, I travel around and I always get the question, so what's the solution? What's the solution? We live in what I call an op-ed culture, in which you have to come up with a solution at the end of everything. And there's not, as The Economist suggests there, there's not a solution. I mean, there's a continuing civil war in Iraq, and it might get worse, four, five, six, seven, 8 years, perhaps, it will gradually get better. But there's no near-term way to fix it, simply because we tend to conceptualize things here as if, well, if the government there would just get it together then and stop squabbling, then they could do something about the war. But the war and the government are interpenetrated. There's no separation between the two. And a lot of the violence now is being affected by militias who are connected very directly to governing parties. And the U.S. has never had enough troops on the ground to be the determining factor there, and it certainly isn't the determining factor now. I think by the end of the year, you'll start to see some American troops withdrawn. And already it takes a great many killed in Iraq to get on the front page of our newspapers. The story is gradually receding to the inside pages. And because television is having such difficulty getting around, they're so vulnerable on the ground, and I've worked with TV crews in Iraq, there's very little television news as well. It takes an enormous attack to actually get it on the network news in any substantial way. So I think Americans will gradually come to, as troops start to come out, they'll turn their eyes to other things. And however horrible the situation on the ground is there, this is an American trope, I should say, this notion of going in like gangbusters with a lot of rhetoric about liberty and democracy. Things don't go too well. You know, I think of it as a spotlight that travels around the world. You know, focuses on a place.
Maybe move on.
And then the spotlight moves on, and the ruins and the other destruction.
If we could name so many things, Darfur is a
Sure.
I wanted, this is a cautionary tale. Mark's book, The Secret Way to War, the Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History. Tell us a bit about the Downing Street Memo. What was it?
Well, you know, we recently, the beginning of the week was May 1st, which was a couple of anniversaries. First, it was Mission Impossible Day. Or, excuse me, not Mission Impossible Day.
Mission Accomplished Day.
Mission Impossible is coming. Also, Mission Impossible. I don't mean to be plumping for Tom Cruise here. But Mission Accomplished Day, which all of you will remember, the images of President Bush striding across the flight deck of the USS Lincoln, that was 3 years ago this past Monday, you know, creating this film that was to be used in the 2004 campaign. You could almost hear the music under it and the slow-mo as he went across the flight deck. And, of course, the aircraft carrier was 30 miles off the coast of California. And, you know, it had been stopped. It was actually supposed to deliver the sailors home that day, but they had stopped it, and they turned it so that you couldn't see the skyline of San Diego, which was clearly visible from the flight deck. Anyway, that day was kind of the high point of the war. The insurgency was already visible at that point, and the weapons of mass destruction were invisible. And that those both of those themes continued. That also was the anniversary of the Downing Street memos leaking a year ago. So May 1st, 2005, this document was published, was leaked to the London Sunday Times. And there's nothing obscure about it. It's simply a record of a cabinet meeting that was held at 10 Downing Street, the equivalent of the White House in Great Britain, a meeting of Tony Blair and his security cabinet. And this meeting was on July 23rd, 2002, so about 8 months before the Iraq War began. And it's this two-page, two-and-a-half-page document. It's very short. It's included in the book, very well written in sort of British public school fashion. These documents are beautifully crafted. And it essentially describes a meeting in which Tony Blair and his cabinet sit down and say, what are we going to do about Iraq? And the intelligence chief, the equivalent of their CIA chief, has just come back from Washington, where he's met with all these American officials, and he gives his report, and he says to the cabinet, well, you know, war is inevitable. President Bush has decided he's definitely going to go to war with Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein. The intelligence and facts are now being fixed around the policy. That's the famous quote. The problem is that the case for war is thin. It's going to be justified by a conjunction of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. And also, wonderful quote, there is little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after the war. And I publish 8 of these documents, actually. And in each one, you see a mounting concern among the British that the Americans aren't planning for the aftermath of the war at all. That, you know, this is obvious. They don't seem to care about that. So that's only one of the prophetic things in this document. But what's interesting is not only that you see the war was planned far, far in advance and decided on far, far in advance, but the problem that is exposed in the memo is not whether to go to war or not, it's how to justify the war. The war itself was already decided on. The question was, how do we tell the world and get the world on board and get Americans and British on board as well? And they go through this very interesting discussion in which the Attorney General says, well, regime change is not a legal basis for going to war. You know, you can't just go to war because you don't like a regime. You can do it because you act in self-defense, but alas, Saddam is not attacking the United States or Great Britain. You can go to war for humanitarian reasons if Saddam was committing genocide, but unfortunately, though he did that in 1988 when the U.S. was allied with him, and in 91 to some extent when the U.S. had troops there, he's not doing it now, so humanitarian reasons aren't good enough. The only way to justify it is through the United Nations. How do we do that? And you have them sitting there saying, well, if we demand that he admit inspectors and he refuses, we can go to war against him. I mean, this is what the Attorney General says and the Prime Minister. And okay, so we'll do that. And it's fascinating watching this idea take shape. And of course, Their main problem is not negotiating with Saddam, it's negotiating with the United States and persuading the Bush administration that they should go to the United Nations, because many in the Bush administration wanted to say, the hell with the United Nations, let's just attack. So they finally do come up with this plan, but it relies on Saddam refusing the inspectors, which of course he did not in the event do. He admitted them. In any case, I encourage people, you know, you don't have to read it in the book, it's on the internet, it's a very short document, but it's very revealing of what was going on in the American and the British government 8 months before the war. 8 months before the war began. And you see that the war itself was what came first, not the justification of it. The justification had to do with selling the war. How can we convince people that we have to go to war? What's the best way to sell it? And there's a wonderful line from Tony Blair in which he says, well, the political strategy, meaning the justification for the war, only has to work long enough for the military strategy to work. That is, people forget about weapons and all the rest of it as soon as we have this great victory.
Yeah.
But of course, the great victory did not come. Yeah.
We're going to open it up to the audience. But I want to ask just one more thing.
Okay.
Because it's on my mind, is the issue of torture and the role of the Supreme Court and how you see that in terms of the fact that we've got this culture of fear, we need security, and so on. Is how the Supreme Court is now reacting to issues like torture.
Boy, that's a... You asked very large questions.
It's on my mind, that, a lot.
And mine, too. Well, I did a book on torture called Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And the book, it's a big, fat book, but two-thirds of it is government documents. I'm a great believer in publishing government documents because I believe that if people just read what the government has said to itself, they can learn a lot about what's happened and why we're living in the times we are. The administration soon after 9/11 essentially made a decision that because the war was based on intelligence information, you had to know where the terrorists were, that it had to use what it called extreme interrogation or torture. And you can see in many of the documents I publish and that have been published elsewhere, this process by which the government, the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, came to decisions about how to use torture and how to get around the commitments that the United States has made not to torture. The U.S. is a signatory of the Convention Against Torture, which is an international treaty. There are a lot of domestic statutes that are put in place to prevent torture following the international treaty. So the administration essentially redefined what the word torture means. There's a wonderful document, wonderful in awful terms, in which torture, the word, is redefined. You know, okay, we're committed not to torture, but what does torture mean? Torture means, according to the Bush administration, anything that will cause pain equivalent to major organ failure or death. So torture is defined at this very high level of absolute, severe, unbearable pain that would actually cause your kidneys to stop functioning or you to die. And once it's defined in that way, you can do an awful lot to somebody without it necessarily being considered under this definition, torture, which is one of the reasons you hear President Bush say repeatedly, we do not torture. The United States does not torture. In effect, he's using this definition. And this is, you ask about the Supreme Court. The court has been, well, I was going to say absent. You know, we haven't had these cases involving torture reach the Supreme Court. They haven't climbed up the court hierarchy at this point. We've had a couple of cases involving Guantanamo, in which the court has said that these prisoners have to have some form of due process, basically. But torture itself, even after the Abu Ghraib photographs, we've had a few lower-level prosecutions of military police who actually were in the photographs. But officials who actually drafted these memos, changed the policy, made it possible to torture, including checking boxes and saying, yes, you can do sleep deprivation, yes, you can do forced stress positions for X number of hours and so on, all those officials are still in power. So in effect, torture has survived its exposure, and we as a society have accepted it.
Right. We're going to open it up to the audience at this time. Please, Larry, I want you to ask this gentleman first, because he has been... Could you introduce yourself?
My name is Jim Kofsky. I'm from Orange County. I'm a retiree of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So I've been involved in this for a while, but I have a question that's not necessarily involves intelligence. I've seen it written and heard it said that the ultimate goal for our invasion of Iraq was the establishment of a democratic society there that would indeed then become the model for all the other countries in the area, and that our goal was that they should then become democratic societies also. And that would abate the pressure on us from the extreme Islamists. But it also would serve to abate the pressure on Israel, too. I'd like to know if you have uncovered any evidence of that.
Yes, well, I think that's a very good question. I think it's...
Mark Danner will be back after these messages.